Hello and welcome to this episode of Epochs, where I should be talking all about the life and times and achievements and legacy of Octavian, otherwise known as Augustus. And I am joined in conversation with Apostolic Majesty. How are you, sir?
Hello, Bo. It's wonderful to be back and wonderful to have an opportunity to discuss this very important topic.
Yeah, and it is a pivotal topic, isn't it? I mean, Augustus, I think, is one of those people in history who sort of, you know, kind of towers over history. There's no way to sort of deny it. You know, someone on the par with Alexander or George Washington, or, I mean, arguably, he's one of the most pivotal people in all of history. I would make that argument. And hopefully in this conversation, we'll let people know why we think that, or why most historians and scholars think that. So before we sort of kick off, what are your sort of overriding thoughts and feelings about the man? Because I suppose there are two ways to look at him. I have this in mind. There's that he's sort of the kindly old grandpa, the version of him in Robert Graves's Augustus, Robert Graves's I, Claudius, where he's like a magic granddad type, loving, benevolent figure. Or he's like one of the most ruthless, cynical warlords of all time. So what's your overall impression of the man?
Well, I think I'm going to be very boring and say that he represents both aspects. You may see them as a sort of totally contradictory, but I would say on the one aspect represents wrath and the other aspect represents wisdom. And I think the brilliance of Augustus is being able to judge when it is necessary to be wrathful and when it is necessary to be wise. And thus explains not just his achievement in terms of solidifying and transitioning the Republic to the Empire, but also in terms of his longevity and indeed his legacy. But in my sort of own particular coming at this recently, obviously I've been thinking about Augustus for a very long time. I don't think anyone who is familiar with history can ignore a figure such as Augustus or Julius Caesar or Alexander the Great or the other examples that you bring up. But in the case of Augustus, I was, for various reasons, I was going through the political philosophy of Dante Alighieri. And in order to try and justify some sort of, you know, you can say grand arc of, you know, I hate to say imperial apologetics, but he was trying to conceive of as some sort of grand metaphysic of the Roman Empire continuing on into the medieval period. And his justification for that was that the reason Christ was born during the reign of the Emperor Augustus was that it was the most perfect reign in all of human history for which to have come into the world. And thereby the authority of the empire was the only authority which was secular and non-Christian that could judge and sentence Christ to death. So in terms of trying to legitimate a system like Augustan rule, that's a medieval perspective. You would think, of course, you know, many Catholics would simply dismiss Augustus as a pagan, but no, there is such a, you can say, veneration of Augustus that stands through the test of time on the one hand in terms of permeating into post-Roman forms of government, into the system of the church, but also into republican forms of government. You can say that Augustus represents this great sort of political catch-all where his legacy is sort of sifted through and various political sort of figures pick one aspect they want to choose and another aspect they want to choose. Because you can look at Augustus and say he is the beginning of divine right monarchy. You can also look at Augustus and say he represents some sort of constitutional precedent for the current US political system or something like that. You can bring in so many different articles and of course arguments. And of course, there is an element of truth in all of these, but you wouldn't be entirely correct for advocating for any of them exclusively either. So obviously, I think you can understand, given the whole range of topics we can sort of invoke here, why it is necessary, I think, to understand Augustus as a pivotal figure in history.
Oh gosh, yeah, absolutely pivotal, absolutely pivotal. I mean, of course, he represents that crossover from Republic to Empire, if nothing else. And as you say, you know, I think he's a very complicated figure, mercurial even, certainly a great, great politician. And a couple of things to point out is that, of course, his reign was very long. He started off when he was like 19. You know, he says at the age of 19, he raised an army to put down a faction and free the state from a tyranny and things. So like Alexander, got to start very, very young and then didn't die till he was old and ruled the whole time. So it's a very, very long reign. Almost too long. I've heard that said about a few different people, like Edward III or someone. It's a bit too long, where a whole generation passes away and there's sort of a break in continuity and things. Or maybe it's not too long. Maybe it needed to be that long. Anyway, one quick thing before we sort of go any further, just to say a quick word, I would like to, about the sources. So I mentioned a few weeks ago, talking about Sulla, that there's actually very little about Sulla. You could read everything there is to read from the primary sources in one day on Sulla. There's the life of Plutarch and there's a few other bits and bobs, not much else. But with Augustus, we've actually got loads, haven't we? There's a Plutarch, there's Suetonius. Even though Tacitus doesn't do it in great detail, still talks about him here and there quite a lot still. You know, Cassius Dio, there's a massive bit in Cassius Dio. Even there's bits and bobs from Cicero for his very, very early life. Cicero mentions him here or there. So we've actually got lots of material on Augustus. That's not even to mention people like Horace or Juvenal or Virgil. So we happen to know loads about the life and times and reign of Augustus, like more than we know about people 1,000 years later, often. So it's in the full light of history. We're actually almost an embarrassment of riches when it comes to the sources. So that's nice. but I was one of those people, Augustus would probably be my specialist subject if I went on Mastermind. I've been fascinated by Augustus ever since I was, I don't know, 16 or 17 or something. Perhaps it was the idea that he was such a young man when he became almost an autocrat. So to focus on the thing about how pivotal he is, just a couple of examples. The idea that in later Roman history, often when you'd have multiple emperors, the Augustus was the senior emperor. You know, just that alone gives an idea. That honorific became the preeminent honorific. And that he was able to, as I mentioned, he was able to bridge that gap between a republic, a really sort of unstable republic in the age of Marius and Sulla and Pompey and Caesar. And by the end of his reign, someone like Tiberius, not even a blood relative, is able to set up, which without any doubt, a monarchy by that point. So I think if you mentioned in the medieval period, you know, he's thought of as in some way sort of a perfect ruler, or he played his hand perfectly in all sorts of ways. And there's very few people in history, aren't there, that you can say, you know, they get to die peacefully in their bed after decades and decades of a completely tumultuous reign. If you want to say any few words on that, or
yes, just to before we sort of get into the events, just comment on that. I think one of the things you and I are probably going to have most to talk about in terms of being able to dissect is what it really means when we talk about the transition from the Republic to the Empire, because of course that entire transition, to which we can even identify what is being transitioned here, is Augustus. It is the person of Augustus, it's the positions he accumulates, and it is his personal legacy. You cannot conceive of any sort of abstract notion of going from republic to monarchy without the figure of Augustus. And given the fact that that is going to be the template for all of, you can say, Western Christian monarchy going forth, which then would transition into, you say, more neoclassical republican institutions in the 17th and 18th century. That in itself is one of the great moments in history. And really, I would also say it's impossible to separate the man from the history in many ways that so many people are destined to demonize or underplay the role of individual agency within history. In the case of Augustus, it's incontrovertible. You cannot see the progression of not just Roman history, but European history and world history without the life and career of the man. So that is what I hope to dissect, what exactly that transition means and what Augustus intended by that and what ultimately his legacy was going forward. I'm happy to get more into it.
They call his settlement, his form of government, the Principate, don't they? Historians, you know, love to put things in nice, neat boxes. But they do say, you know, that the Augustan era is just an entirely new settlement for the Roman world. And it does seem fair. But yeah, the idea, often people say he's the first emperor. You know, some say that someone like Caesar might have been the first emperor. Others say, no, it wasn't until Vespasian when he's truly an emperor. Does away with the idea of being a princeps, a first citizen, is a true emperor. And others put it even later. But, anyway, we could go on and on and on about that transition and what it is. But let's dive into it then. So I suppose if we go through sort of vaguely chronologically and talk about all the repercussions as we go along, I think the first thing to mention about Augustus, or any great figure, because you're absolutely right, without him, history would be different. You know, if Alexander dies when he's 21, all of history is different. If Augustus dies when he's 25 or something, all of history is different, right? Napoleon dies just before he becomes emperor, all of his subsequent history is different. So it's that sort of important. So when he's young, his sort of formative years, he's one of those people where his own family is, they're not plebeian, but they're certainly not fantastically wealthy and rich. But his great uncle is Julius Caesar, right? So there's someone in your family, not exactly like your father, but someone relatively close to you in your family is unbelievably powerful and important and rich, among the first men in the world. In the Roman world. So that would have been his formative years growing up. And we know that Caesar didn't have, well, unless you count Cleopatra's son, Caesar didn't have a clear, clear heir. So I think maybe it's important to just say a few words or spend a couple of moments thinking about what it must have been like for Octavian, as he was then, or Octavius. Growing up, knowing that your great uncle is this figure, this great figure, and he's sort of also in trouble. And there are also civil wars about it going on all at the same time. What's your impression of sort of the world that Augustus grew up in and what effect that must have had on him? Just quickly say, because by the time he is 18, 19, it seems, he's absolutely ready to jump onto the stage of history and start being an actor in his own right and playing his hand boldly. To do that when you're 18, 19 years old, what must have his slightly earlier years have been? What must have they been like?
Well, he was part of the Octavianus sort of branch of the Julii gens, which was a very sort of insignificant branch of the family, which Julius Caesar, albeit Caesar was also a branch of the Julii gens, his was far more distinguished than that of the paternal ancestry of Octavianus. And indeed, Octavian itself is really a pejorative if we're trying to understand the man. So I find it interesting that you look at Augustus and then you look at Octavian, because if you look at that, it doesn't actually really make much sense in terms of this random, you know, boy of an equestrian rank suddenly becoming or being given a title, which is, I'll get into what the title means later on when we arrive at it. But I think it's really important to note that he becomes Caesar before he becomes Augustus, when he inherits essentially the title and the legacy when it comes from Julius Caesar. But when Octavius is born in the year, 63 AD, the link to Caesar is through... BC, thank you, is through his mother, Aetia, who is the niece of Caesar. And that is a time where the first informal understanding, the triumvirate, has been formed between Caesar, Pompey the Great, and Crassus. A few years later, Caesar will begin his conquest in Gaul. But what does this all mean, like, in the grand sort of scheme of Roman history? Because Caesar and Octavian, later Caesar, and Augustus are really coming in at the tail end of a system which is unraveling and falling apart and just evolving into civil wars. I think it's really fair to say that the Roman Empire had been in a state of almost perpetual crisis since probably the Third Punic Wars and the sack of Carthage around the year 150 BC. Because after then, the senatorial class becomes, you could say, more distant, more corrupt. The Roman legions expand. The Marian reforms essentially lead to these, you know, barracks rulers and coup after coup. I mean, Sulla, Hugh mentioned earlier as having, you know, not much sources that we can ultimately attribute to him or his reign, or sorry, not reign, life. Again, these words actually have major connotations in terms of understanding what does it mean to have a reign, even if you don't really have a monarchical system, which is recognizable at that point. All of these things are sort of interesting to consider. But Sulla is another interesting figure that you can later bring back in terms of what he means to Augustus, because he's a man who is a great warlord. He fights Mithridates, the king of Pontus. He comes back. He launches a series of proscriptions, a terror purge, essentially killing off many of his political enemies. And then he attempts, after having done all that, to correct the flaws in the republican system. After serving as dictator, he then retires. But shortly afterwards, his legacy unravels through, again, another series of conflicts. So during the time you have the birth of Augustus and the creation of the first triumvirate and his rather distant connection, genetic link, to Julius Caesar as his great uncle. When you see the creation of the triumvirate, it's basically an admission that the republican institutions mean very little. You know, it doesn't really matter who is, you know, Pontifex Maximus or consul or all of these other positions, because true power is being wielded by these either incredibly wealthy men like Crassus, these men with great personal prestige like Pompey the Great, who, having of course basically completed the legacy of Sulla through his consolidation of the East. And then we have a up-and-comer who is distinguished by his lineage, but also by his ambitions, which is Julius Caesar, who begins his career by taking over three important provinces in the north of it and the north of Italy and southern Gaul, and then uses that essentially as a springboard to, you can almost say, it begins as a series of conflicts used to justify the security of Rome's northern borders. And then it rapidly becomes a personal campaign of conquest, where the legality of such actions is increasingly drawn into question. Not only does he expand the Roman borders to the Rhine, not only does he defeat Vercingetorix by constantly expanding basically the remit of who was at war with Rome, who was an enemy. The Caesarian legions, also the first to cross over into Britain, the first to build a bridge to cross over into the Rhine, all of these expeditions. And of course, the more powerful he gets, the more antithetical he seems to the republican institutions. Crossing the Rubicon effectively is a decision to declare war on the Republic, to seize it by force. And from the year 49 BC up into the year 45 BC, he is really fighting constant wars with a whole series of figures, the most prominent of being Pompey the Great, who he defeats at the Battle of Pharsalus. So within this entire scheme, you mentioned the idea of Octavian being the heir of Julius Caesar. And I just want to reference that again, because what does it really mean to be the heir of Julius Caesar? I mean, political heirs didn't really exist in Rome at that time. You had a huge veneration of the family, of lineages, and your lineage and your status in Roman society, whether you were a pleb, whether you were a quaestor, whether you were a patrician, etc., could allow you to appeal to certain ranks and positions, such as being a member of the Senate. But nevertheless, so much of the Roman political system is built up on personal achievement, imperator, the conquering general, the ability essentially to not just kill the enemies of Rome, but protect the citizens of Rome. So if we're going to talk about Augustus and as an heir, essentially, what Augustus effectively receives when Caesar is assassinated in 44 is a name and a contested legacy in terms of the will, because ultimately the will becomes not so much in terms of like a basis for power in and of itself as a political office, but the will basically allows him to have a foundation from which to start selling off his estates and begin building an army. But what's significant about this is that really Octavianus, up until the age of 18, 19, really doesn't feature prominently in Roman history at all. The whole notion of him being an heir is really quite surprising. It's something that is effectively sort of presented during the course of when the will is read out during the funeral. And figures like Cicero and even Mark Antony are, you know, struck at this, you know, this, because he's not also the only blood relative of Julius Caesar either. He has other nephews. So the idea that this particular child, effectively, who had only undergone his ceremony of attaining manhood a few years earlier, should suddenly inherit the name is rather remarkable. But so it's that is in itself remarkable. The fact that he inherited the legacy of Caesar, not the offices of dictator, not all of the legions of Caesar either, none of the things that would allow him to take over power and begin ruling at the age of 19. But he inherits that legacy, and more critically, he decides to assume that legacy. It is a conscious decision that Augustus takes, that I am going to take my uncle's name and I am going to become Caesar. It is something no one expected him to do. Basically, everyone thought he was a boy who had this position, again, inherited by accident. He has very little allies. Mark Antony doesn't take him seriously. The former sort of optimates don't take him seriously, i.e. the elite ranks of the, you know, senatorial class. Cicero doesn't take him seriously. Even his, well, what I found fascinating actually rereading this subject is that even his mother, Aetia, encouraged him to not accept the legacy of Caesar because it would basically place a massive target on him. So that really is the context, that Julius Caesar and his legacy essentially could have died when the quote-unquote liberators assassinated him, and then Cassius and Brutus could have consolidated a new regime. It wouldn't have saved the Republic, almost likely, you know, very likely, but we could have seen just a perpetuation of the civil conflict that we saw before the rise of Julius Caesar. Octavius could have decided to back down, or he could have been assassinated very early, and all of history would have looked entirely different. So it's not just the fact that this boy inherited his position, rather he decided to seize the legacy, not simply inherit the legacy.
Absolutely, that's a remarkable thing. I mean, really, sort of almost unbelievably remarkable. There's lots of times in history when someone very, very young has to step into the breach, and they're completely ineffective, as, and you can't really blame them, really, being William the Conqueror, jumps to mind, being extremely young. If you haven't got protectors who are completely on your side, it'd be very, very difficult. But Octavian seems to pick up the mantle completely on his own. So, yeah, the idea that he inherits the name, so he becomes sort of paterfamilias, he becomes legally the head of that household. Well, you know, good luck in the world in which he is existing in at that moment. But the thing I think is sort of even more interesting, or not more interesting, but the thing that's truly, truly remarkable is that he was able to convert it very quickly. You mentioned, like, there's a famous line from Cicero saying this boy is to be sort of placated for a while and then just swept aside. He can't be, you know, it's just, there's no way he can be a true player on this stage. It's just, there's no way that's possible. But it was. So again, there's that idea of what forged him. So all his childhood, really, I imagine from when his first real memories kick in, when he's first sort of old enough to be aware of what's going on around him. I don't know when that was for you, but you can't be much younger than 7, 8, 9, 10 years old when you're able to really understand what's going on. Already at that point, the Catiline conspiracy is in the past. His great uncle is in Gaul doing that thing. And then when he's going through the years when he's old enough to sort of truly understand what's going on, when you're sort of 14, 15, 16, those are the years when Caesar's fighting Pompey and fighting all over the Roman world for supremacy, and then winning, and then ruling as a dictator, or in the end, dictator for life. Those are the years when he's, you know, when he's 15, 16, 17, 18, are those years. So he sees how it's done, or rather how it's not done. He could, you know, what an education that is. You know, talk about being thrown in, baptism of fire, being thrown in the deep end, immediately being, not involved politically, but being right next to the actor of the age in right next to him. So there's a few things he did when he, I think when he was 16, he went out to Spain and visited Caesar while Caesar was campaigning in Spain.
It was very traditional, wasn't it? When you become a man, you effectively become a camp follower, and you're expected essentially to take up military responsibility alongside your relatives. But again, it's quite remarkable, isn't it, to become nothing more than a camp follower, to be the driver of a legacy of the magnitude of Caesar within 3 years. And this is really what's startling. It's interesting that you brought up Cicero, because you would have thought, based on what you just said, wouldn't you, about his entire sort of formative experience being left in the legacy of Caesar, either in the conquest of Gaul or the period of dictatorship from 49 until 44 BC, that a more primitive, and you can say brutish, character would have looked at that and said, oh, I just want to be Caesar. I just want to be the dictator. I want to assume power and I want everyone to submit to me. But part of the genius of Augustus is the fact that he, from a very early age, has a clear conception of his role within the grand scope of Roman history. You know, it's something that Cicero, of course, is obsessed with in terms of understanding the past, in terms of understanding yourself. Of course, Caesar turned that into his great sort of political rallying cry to some extent, the importance of lineage. But of course, when it comes to Augustus, one of the first things he does is not simply go out as we imagine and take vengeance against the murders of his adopted father, Julius Caesar. But instead, he occupies this halfway house position where he actually goes after Mark Antony. He becomes the champion of the Roman elite, and he panders almost excessively to Cicero. And so it's remarkable in the way that you bring up that famous quote, he is basically to be used as an ornament and then discarded. We can exploit the name, can't we? We understand that it may be very useful for our purposes to take the heir of Caesar and then use him as a weapon of the liberators, effectively, and then discard him should he actually begin to assume that Caesar would mean anything as a political tool in the long term. So that is very much Cicero's thinking. But it's very interesting that Augustus wants to appeal to both legacies early on. At the beginning, he wants to appeal to the legacy of his father, and he wants to appeal to the legacy of the man who brought down the Catiline conspiracy. So to him, as we later see with maybe Mark Antony, in the same way that he's looking at, you know, acts of vengeance, he's also looking for new Catiline conspiracies, essentially. So at the one hand, he's furthering the legacy of political consolidation of his father, yet he's also saving the Republic. Two themes which you would seem to be, you know, mutually exclusive, but ultimately you can say they form part of the remarkable legacy of Augustus. It's only much later, you know, a year or so later, that having essentially established this position, and you mentioned again remarkable thing about how he's able to achieve so much power so early. One of the many sort of facets of Augustus that allowed him to stay in power for so long was his copious generosity. It wasn't simply enough to hang on and receive the estates of Julius Caesar. You had to purchase loyalty. You had to purchase the legions. You had to outbid Mark Antony whenever you were appealing effectively to the loyalty of the same soldiers. And it was his willingness to use the estates of Julius Caesar as a political legacy, effectively, to invest that into buying the loyalty of his former legionnaires, that very early on makes him a necessity for people like Cicero, but then allows him to ally with people like Mark Antony and basically go on and achieve the act of vengeance against the murderers of his adoptive father, the liberators. But of course, that means that's another contradiction, because you have the legions, you have set up a power base. Now you understand that Cicero is not going to be a strong ally for you. You understand that you have, almost as an act of political necessity, to take the fight to Brutus and Cassius. And yet, on the other hand, you have to pander, you can say, to the excessive brutality of someone like a Mark Antony, who wants to go back into Rome and commit massive proscriptions. So Caesar, rather than preventing the murder of all of these Roman elites, basically turns a blind eye and lets it happen again. So on the one hand, you can say he's trying to appeal to the legacy of clemency of Julius Caesar, yet also he has to open up and become this wrathful figure in terms of being able to allow him to continue down the path of power.
So a couple of quick things. One, you've mentioned Caesar as his father a couple of times there, but we already said that he's his great uncle. So a couple of things to mention, just to go back to that moment in time when Caesar's assassinated, and in his will is made clear that he's adopted, sort of formally adopted Octavian as his son and heir. So at that point then, Octavian can say, my father was Julius Caesar, the divine Julius Caesar. They sort of deified Caesar after.
And of course, then it's not just that he is Caesar; he is son of a god, right, as well.
So that's exactly what I was going to say. So Octavian goes through many, many different titles and names, many during his life. The last one is Augustus. But yeah, at that point, he calls himself. What is the Latin? Divi Filius or something.
Yes.
The son of a god, son of the divine Julius, basically. And so, if we could go back briefly to that moment in time. So he knows that he's very, very close to Caesar, literally gone on campaign with him, and must have spent a fair amount of time, or at least a little bit of time, in his company. And Caesar, Julius Caesar, obviously took a shine to him, otherwise he wouldn't have left is what he did to him in his will. But yet there is Caesarion in Egypt. There is that boy there by Cleopatra. And so, again, it must have been, obvious to say, an unbelievable shock when Octavian hears that Uncle Julius, great Uncle Julius, has been, just been murdered. He doesn't necessarily know what the will is going to say. He might fear, at least for a moment or two, that his assassins are going to come after him or the whole family, but they don't. So one, we've already said, it's absolutely remarkable that he was able to step up to the plate, to use parlance of our time, and start acting as a political player in his own right. But beyond that, to be able to not only have the guts or the balls to try, but then to play his hand very, very well. So in the first instance, to realise that he's got multiple enemies. Of course, there's the people that just murdered Caesar, so Brutus and others. But also to realise that Mark Antony, Octavian, is going to have a power struggle for supremacy within the Caesarian camp, because Mark Antony obviously thinks of himself as the natural, not sort of legal heir, but the natural successor to Caesar when it comes to, you know, legions and or just being ahead of that faction from now on. So he's got, Octavian has got two completely separate factions that he will have to fight against if he is to win ultimately. And so, so there's two things. One, just the nous, the guts to even try to do this. And then secondly, a political acumen. Like, where does this 18, 19-year-old kid get a political acumen to realise, okay, I will exploit the name of Caesar. I'll start calling myself the son of a god. Right, okay, do that. I'll have to go through the legal battles of actually getting the money to actually do it. And when I do, to pay off the lead. Again, the political acumen or the political ability to realise, to see with sort of a laser-like focus, I've got to pay the legions. I can't just take that for myself or squander it or do other things with it. The legions are absolutely important. Again, to play Cicero like a fiddle, really. Oh, you think you're going to manipulate me? No, I'm manipulating you, if anything. And then, again, to have, like, again, the political ability to realise that very quickly or almost straight away to call out the murderers and say, you know, I'm not going to have that. Not straight away, but fairly quickly, to say that that's a line in the sand that needs to be dealt with, because he gets himself created consul very quickly. Is it within a year or is it 2 years? before he winds up as he's sort of manipulated events so that he can be consul completely illegally. He's not old enough. He hasn't gone through the Cursus Honorum remotely. So anyway, I just think there's two things that are absolutely remarkable. One, to have the balls to even try this. And two, to have the political ability to not immediately fail. Right? And he's got people around him like Maecenas and Agrippa, but they're about his age. They're not much older or anything. How he wasn't murdered by somebody in the first year or two is incredible, right?
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.